I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and this is the Leonard Lopate Show. More than most presidential elections, the 2008 contest has become about the power of rhetoric itself, writes Robert Schlesinger, a veteran Washington reporter. He's just written a new book, White House Ghosts, Presidents and Their Speechwriters, in which he opens a revealing window on the modern presidency from FDR to George W. Bush by examining the crucial and often hidden role played by speechwriters. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm pleased it brings Robert Schlesinger to the show today. I'm sorry, I'm messing up your name, Robert.
No, it's
Robert.
It's,
welcome.
You're getting it as well as ever, anyone else does. It's technically Schlesinger, but even my mother doesn't pronounce it that way, so you're pretty safe.
And how does she pronounce it?
She says Schlesinger.
Wow, even your mom.
Yep.
In a recent article, you wrote that Senator John McCain has picked up on Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton's theme that the election is about, quote, speeches versus solutions, talk versus action. Isn't this because neither one can match Obama's oratory skills?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, what I said in that article was that most people forget, and I say this in White House Ghosts, that even John F. Kennedy, who is has often been Obama has been compared to him, understood that rhetoric has great power and plays a vital role for presidents, mm-hmm. but there's also limits to it.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, as you said, I think the reason that McCain and Clinton are going after Obama on rhetoric is because it is his strength, and they want to try to disarm him there. Mm-hmm.
Are they making any headway, you think?
I think that is an argument that's been picked up in the media and is making some headway, but we'll see ultimately how he adjusts. I mean, it's like any mm-hmm. pitching batter matchup where he had a fastball that was working pretty well, and now they're starting to get the bat on it, so we'll see how his curve is. Mm-hmm.
Is it making any headway with voters, do you think?
Unclear.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see as the primaries go forward, and we'll see what happens in Pennsylvania tomorrow and Indiana, North Carolina down the road. But, you know, he certainly has had an appeal based on it, so we'll see how well it holds up.
Now, in the same article, you revealed that among the foremost skeptics of the power of rhetoric was President Kennedy, John F. Kennedy.
Exactly. As I explained in White House Ghosts, Kennedy, more than most presidents, understood the power of presidential rhetoric and its importance, but he was also very skeptical of it. And he liked to invoke Shakespeare, the line in Henry IV, Part 1, where one character says, "Well, I can summon spirits from the vasty deep," and the other character says, "Well, so can I, so can any man, but do they come when you do call them?" And Kennedy understood that it's not simply enough to give a speech, but it has to be in the right context at the right moment, given by the right person.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, it would probably come as surprising that, you know, 45 years after his death, Kennedy is remembered as a brilliant orator. So was he always gifted as an orator?
It's actually interesting. He started when he first ran for Congress in 1946, he was terrible at giving speeches. But he really worked at it over the subsequent 15 years, had speech coaches and practiced, and as I said, he understood the importance of it and became the polished speaker that we all remember.
Mm-hmm. So did he ever lose that skepticism about the power of rhetoric?
No. And again, it's not to say that he didn't appreciate it, which he obviously did, but even there's a scene in White House Ghosts where after he gave his famous speech on civil rights in June of 1963, and you know, he's told, "Oh, this is your greatest speech," and he said, "Well, you know, still look what happened in the House of Representatives the next day, where a bill that the administration had supported was voted down in a surprise move." And he said, "You know, he was saying essentially, I summoned the moral spirits from the vasty deep, but it really didn't make a difference in terms of the day-to-day governing the next day."
Mm-hmm. Now, where did your interest in speechwriters come from? Is it because of your father, who is Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the historian and Kennedy speechwriter?
Ultimately, yeah. He was part of a society of former presidential speechwriters, and they get together every couple of years and have down in Washington and have dinners where they get up and tell these really fascinating, entertaining stories about their time in the White House, their presidents. And I got to go to a couple of these and heard these stories and thought these are really either funny or insightful. And I thought, well, gee, someone should write them down. And then I thought, wait, I can write them down. So that's how it got started.
Uh-huh. And how long ago, how long did it take you?
I started probably in late 2005, so 3 years. No, I'm sorry. I started in late 2004, so three years, give or take.
So your book covers 80 years of presidential speechwriters, from Raymond Mulley under FDR through Ted Sorensen and your father under JFK, Jack Valenti and Richard Goodwin under LBJ, Bill Sapphire, Pat Buchanan under Nixon, Hendrik Hertzberg and James Fallows under Carter, and Peggy Noonan under Reagan, to the troika of Michael Gerson, now my colleague at the Washington Post, John McConnell, now a dear friend and also a Carleton grad, and Matthew Scully under George W. Bush. And not all of the presidents I just mentioned worked well.
And scores more, I should add.
Yes, of course. But not all of these presidents worked well with their speechwriters.
This is one of the things that I found interesting, and was seeing which presidents understood the power, the importance of public speaking, and using speechwriters to kind of as a prism through which to view the presidents and make judgments about them. Jimmy Carter never was comfortable with speechwriters, never was able to really harness the bully pulpit, as it were. George H.W. Bush was very fond of his speechwriters, but just always felt like he should be judged on actions and on substance, not on words. And he didn't really put as much weight onto the speaking aspect of the presidency as he should have. And I don't think it's any coincidence that neither Jimmy Carter nor George H.W. Bush was reelected.
Do you think that's?
I'm not saying that's the sole reason, but
I think in order
to be an effective president, you need to at least have an appreciation of the rhetorical tools available and understand that's an important part of the president's arsenal, as it were.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart here for Leonard Lopate, and we're talking about White House ghosts, presidents and their speechwriters, from FDR to George W. Bush, written by Robert Schlesinger.
Just say Schlesinger, it's fine.
Schlesinger. So let me ask you, was FDR the first president to have a full-time staff of speechwriters?
Actually, no. Many presidents, Washington onward, have had occasional help with their public communications. Warren Harding had a fellow named Judson Welliver, who was his literary clerk and is generally considered to be the first presidential speechwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's any mistake that the first president who really had to deal with radio was also the first president who had a speechwriter. But it was really under FDR that FDR was such a master of the medium of radio and transformed modern public communications for presidents. So he seemed like the best place to start in terms of starting this book.
Mm-hmm. Which of the presidents you researched had the biggest team of speechwriters?
You know, it has sort of expanded and contracted from LBJ on. I mean, I think at different times Ford had a lot of people. Nixon had, over the years, a couple of dozen people. Reagan had, I think, a dozen people. Clinton, over the years, had innumerable. I mean, trying to track down all the Clinton speechwriters was was sort of a daunting task, but so many of them were so helpful.
And of the presidents, when you mentioned President Clinton, and President Clinton is someone you would always hear was the person who was, you know, futzing with his speeches up until the very last minute. Was he part of the speech writing process, or was he just a nitpicker?
No, he was. It would depend on the specific speech in terms of how much he'd be engaged in the actual writing. But with Clinton, he was so talented at taking a speech and just winging it, sort of riffing off the speech and then coming back to it. There's a great scene in White House Ghosts where he's got a speech and he's working on it in a limousine with his speechwriter on the way to the speech, and he's not working off the current copy, and there are pages floating around. He's saying which draft is this? Is this the current one? And they get to the speech, and the speechwriter is thinking, this is a disaster. I'm going to be fired because, you know, this is...
We don't know which version of the speech.
And Clinton just grabs the bundle of papers, goes up to the podium. This is at American University. And Clinton starts out by telling a joke about how when he was at Georgetown, he dated an AU girl. And the speechwriter's like, oh, no. And then Clinton gives with this jumble of papers, it's the mix of the two drafts, gives a perfect speech. And the speechwriter just sort of sits there amazed, and Clinton used paragraphs from the different drafts, and he just extemporized stuff, and it was a better speech than whatever they had written. And this was the power of Clinton.
Well, I was going to say that speaks to the power of the person who's actually giving the speech. There's only so much a speechwriter can do, correct?
Absolutely. And so much of it is... I mean, I think there's, to some extent, a perception with speechwriters as sort of a scriptwriter handing something to the politician who then goes out and reads the speech. But each president is so engaged one way or the other, and they are all differently, and that's part of the fun of the book. But each president is so engaged that there's really never a case of, here's your script, go read it.
Let's go back to FDR, and we want to play one of the clips. One of the most important speeches President Roosevelt gave was in the wake of Pearl Harbor on December 8th, 1941. Let's listen to a clip.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost.
Who helped FDR with this speech?
That's a really interesting example because, as I explained in White House Ghosts, this is an example where late in the afternoon on December 7th, 1941, FDR summons his secretary into his private study and is sitting there with smoking a cigarette and says, sit down, and dictates himself the body of the speech. And he actually had it yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in world history. The United States of America was simultaneously attacked. And he then, you can go to the FDR library and find the speech and see where he scratched out history and put in infamy. And he'd gotten help with it from with edits from people like Harry Hopkins, who was one of his important speechwriters. But that was one where FDR basically did it himself.
So there was no give and take before he gave this speech?
No. I mean, he summoned in his secretary and just dictated it. And then there was some revision after that that involved some of his other staffers. But the bulk of it was FDR.
And how many drafts did he go through?
Of that speech?
Yeah.
It wasn't very many. It was two or three. I don't remember the exact number.
Mm-hmm. So sort of a, from the heart type.
Right, exactly.
From the heart type speech. Did he write it? Did he write it longhand?
No, he dictated it. So I mean, it's literally, it was yesterday, comma, December 7th, comma, 1941, comma, a date which will live in world history and history, comma, and so on and like that.
Any idea why were you able to discover why he changed or what led him to change world history to infamy?
You know, that's a great question. I wish I knew the answer, but that could be my next book, exactly.
When researching this book, how many past and present speechwriters did you interview?
I was very fortunate. I interviewed over 90 current and former speechwriters and a couple of other top officials. I managed to get at least one person from every administration, FDR, through the current one. And they were just all so generous with their time and their stories, and that's what I think really makes it a fun book.
Mm-hmm. Generous, but were they willing to be candid with you about behind the scenes, what
happened? In many cases, they were surprisingly candid, yeah. And Sorry, go on.
No, no, no. You're the guest. No, keep going. Talk.
No, I mean, and there are fun little moments in here in this book where I remember being in an interview and like, wow, you're really telling me that. I mean, there was one a Nixon speechwriter was working on the State of the Union and had sort of a nervous exhaustion collapse and was seeing bends in hallways where there weren't. And I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, you know, I'd been up for 3 days because the White House doctor had given me a lot of uppers. I thought, really? was that common? Or there's another...
Wait, no, you can't just say that and then not say, what was his answer to that
question?
Oh,
no, no. Well, his answer...
Was that common?
Well, no, he said he didn't think it was common, but he was quick to point out that it was legal at the time.
Well, you're going to share another anecdote.
Actually, from the current administration, where there was a speechwriter who had been a Clinton speechwriter on the National Security Council and stayed on the Bush administration. He was a political appointee, so it wasn't like he just got to stay on. He sort of reapplied for his job. And after 9/11, he was one of the people contributing to Bush's speech before Congress on September 20th, 2001, one of his former Clinton colleagues sends in some suggested speech language, and he says, this looks good. I think I'll put it in there. And he doesn't tell anyone where it came from and slips into the speech, and it stays in. And one of Bush's famous lines from that speech, whether we bring our enemies to justice or justice to our enemies, justice will be done, secretly was provided by a Clinton speechwriter. No one in the White House knew it except for this one guy.
Ooh. It's a great point to go to a break for 1 second. All right. Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking with Robert Schlesinger about his new book, White House Ghosts, Presidents and Their Speechwriters. I'm Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This is the Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm on WNYC and WNYC.org, speaking with Robert Schlesinger about his new book, White House Ghosts, Presidents and Their Speechwriters. And before we went to break, you just told a delicious story about a Clinton speechwriter slipping something into a George W. Bush speech, and no one was the wiser. Was this the first time that became
public? This is the first time it became public, is in White House Ghosts. And it was, again, one of those great interviews where the Clinton speechwriter gave me the thing he'd sent in, and I was sort of like, wow, you're telling me this? This is great.
Were you able to, did you name the name?
Oh, yeah. The Clinton guy is a guy named Tom Malinowski, who was Clinton's chief NSC speechwriter, and then... The fellow who was the Clinton writer who stayed on under the Bush administration was a guy named John Gibson. He had a very funny take on making the switch from one to the other, where he said, you know, he said that first day of work at the Bush administration, I felt like kind of like somebody who was at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, and all of my friends had just caught the last helicopter off the rooftop. But he said they were very welcoming, and he said, you know, aside from the ideological vertigo, it was great.
Now let's talk about rivalries among speechwriters. Is it common?
It is. It depends on the administration. Sometimes it's common, but of course the current Bush administration is surprisingly well known for its rivalries, where there were, as you said at the top, there were three speechwriters: Michael Gerson, your new colleague at the Post, Matthew Scully, who is now writing for Senator McCain, and John McConnell, who is still, who's technically Vice President Cheney's speechwriter and is still at the White House. They either wrote or edited, one way or another, they had their hands in all of, essentially, of President Bush's first term talks. And they would write together and they would edit together, and they were sort of great friends and had a great time. But if you were seeing it from the outside, all the press coverage was there was a storyline of Michael Gerson, the kind of lone genius who would go to Starbucks and scribble, and somehow his colleagues never made it into the coverage, and this rather irked them. And then last year, Scully wrote a damning piece in the Atlantic Monthly, laying bare the frustrations of being a ghost of a ghost, as it were.
And you know, I've talked to John McConnell about these, and, you know, he demurs. He doesn't
He's very old school that way.
Yeah, doesn't want to talk about it. Were you able to talk to him? Did he talk to you?
He talked to me for the book, and right. He was very helpful. And he's one of these. He's a square-jawed Wisconsinite that is like something out of the 1950s in terms of like a straight-shooting all-American guy.
Right.
And
Carleton grad. I'm gonna say it again.
Exactly.
Carleton grad.
And but when it came to the actual Scully Gerson contretemps, he was not particularly interested in adding his two cents to the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, in all the stories, when Scully wrote his piece and Gerson responded, the stories always had John McConnell did not comment. John
right.
McConnell couldn't be reached for comment.
And actually, I assume it was by coincidence, but when the story first came out and there was a big, it dominated sort of the Washington gossip circuit for a week, McConnell was out of the country. He'd gone on vacation.
Good for him, and I bet he was thinking the same thing. So how did that story arc develop that Michael Gerson was sort of the Lone Ranger? You know, Bush. If Karl Rove was Bush's brain, then Michael Gerson was
his tongue.
His tongue, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's one of those interesting things that's changed so much in the period of time covered in White House Ghosts, where there's no longer. And I think with good reason, there's no longer a presumption that the president writes his own speeches. But there's no longer even a kind of, it used to be that, yes, the president has speechwriters, and eventually maybe some fine history book like White House Ghosts will tell you about what happened. But there used to be more of a, still keep him off stage a little bit. But it really struck me with that whole with that whole squabble, how much it's just, you know, it's no longer whether the president should get credit for its words, but should the chief speechwriter get credit for the words, or the next guy, you know, should it be shared? And it's sort of a very 21st century fight that this couldn't have happened 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Johnson for a second. I want us to play a clip of Johnson. Now, he's not one of the top presidents remembered for his oratory skills. But he did respond with real eloquence to several crises during his tenure. One of the more famous speeches he gave was on March 15th, 1965, in response to the crises in Selma, Alabama. Let's listen to a brief clip from that speech.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. I urge every member of both parties, Americans of all religions and of all colors, from every section of this country, to join me in that cause. At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama.
President Johnson, before we played that clip and I said we were going to talk about President Johnson, you said, I love President Johnson.
The Johnson chapter was one of the chapters that was so much fun for me to write because there are historic speeches like this one, and I get chills every time I hear that speech, the We Shall Overcome speech. But there are a lot of smaller, more obscure stories and vignettes and speeches you haven't heard of, and interesting characters as speechwriters. And so it was so much fun to pull it all together, and there's so much in that chapter.
And how much of that speech and other speeches that he gave did President Johnson put himself into the process?
That was that speech was written by Richard Goodwin, who was his chief speechwriter, his top speechwriter at the time. There's a great scene in White House Ghosts where Goodwin, the night before Johnson's given the speech, gets word that he's going to speak and is out at a dinner party and comes home and is like, "Am I going to be summoned?" And he isn't. He thinks, "Okay, fine. I'm happy not to write it," and goes to bed. Comes into work the next day and Johnson's aide, Jack Valenti, is sitting outside of his office, and apparently Johnson had chewed out Valenti that morning and said, "What, you didn't put Goodwin on?" And Johnson said, "Don't you know a liberal Jew has his hand on the pulse of America? And you assign the most important speech of my life to a Texas public relations man? Get Dick to do it, and now!" And so Goodwin has X number of hours to write the speech, and every time he finishes a page, he hands it off for presidential review, and it goes down, and Johnson and others edit it. He missed the teleprompter deadline. But it's a great question you asked: how much of that is Johnson, how much of it is the speechwriter? And Goodwin had a great take on that. He said, he later wrote, "Although I had written the speech, fully believed in what I had written, the document was pure Johnson. My job was not limited to guessing what the president might say exactly as he would express it, but to heighten and polish, illuminate, as it were, his inward beliefs and natural idiom, to attain not a strained mimicry, but an authenticity of expression. I would not have written the same speech in the same way for Kennedy or any other politician or for myself. It was by me, but it was for and of the Lyndon Johnson I had carefully studied and come to know." And I think that's a great sort of summation of what, when it works properly, what is the role of a speechwriter.
Are there some things that only a president can write?
That's a very good question. I would think there must be.
Or is it just that the president just has ideas, like FDR with his Pearl Harbor speech, where he sits down, just writes it, and then hands it off? And
there are examples sprinkled throughout White House Ghosts of both things where a president organically came up with a speech or a phrase, or a speechwriter came up with it. But ultimately, you know, the president has to have ownership of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about Nixon.
Oh, yeah.
What's the story behind Richard Nixon's "I'm not a crook" speech?
That was Nixon would give most of Nixon's speeches were planned ad libs. He would write down an outline for a speech. He'd commit it to memory and then just go and give it without notes, and invariably wow his audience that he was speaking extemporaneously. And of course, during the height of Watergate, he was making an appearance down in Florida, I believe, and doing a question and answer with the Associated Press editors in November 1973. And Pat Buchanan, who is the conservative commentator, was then one of his speechwriters, would always give him briefing books of what he wanted to say, and you know, in anticipation of questions being asked. And Nixon at one point answers, "Well, you know, people have to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook." And Buchanan gets the briefing book back, and Nixon had scribbled the thing on the briefing book. So he'd obviously, thought it through and written it down as a note to himself to say it.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Robert Schlesinger about his new book, White House Ghosts. We were just talking about Richard Nixon. Let's play another presidential clip. This one is President Nixon on the day he resigned. Oh, was it Ford or Nixon? It's Ford on the day Nixon resigned.
"My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule. But there is a higher power. By whatever name, we honor him, who ordains not only righteousness but love, not only justice but mercy. As we bind up the internal wounds of Watergate, more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, let us restore the golden rule to our political process, and let brotherly love purge our hearts of suspicion and of hate."
That was President Ford on the day after President Nixon resigned.
"Our long national nightmare is over." Ford read that and said, isn't it a little bit hard on Dick? And his speechwriter, Robert Hartman, who actually just died recently, said, you know, you can do anything else you want to the speech, but you have to keep that line in. And, of course, it's what everyone remembers best Ford best for.
Why the insistence on keeping that line?
Because he understood, Hartman instinctively understood that it would be sort of a balm and a signal to the country that things were changing.
Mm-hmm. Any idea what President Nixon's reaction was to having his presidency, the second term, such as it was, being described as a long national nightmare?
You know, that's a great question. I wish I knew what his response was, but I don't.
All right, now let's talk about our modern day, present day great orator, and that's Senator Obama.
Okay.
As we said at the top of this interview, he's being knocked around for, as Senator Clinton would say, great speeches, but not a whole lot of there. Is it possible for someone to just be a great orator and not have any follow through?
It is possible. It's hard to be successful if you just have the one. I mean, as presidents, as I said, and I think I show in White House Ghosts, speech giving and the ability to communicate with the public is an important sort of tool in the box, mm-hmm. and you absolutely need it. But you also need to understand that it's one tool of many. So the question that Obama needs to answer and demonstrate is, does he have the other tools?
Mm-hmm. What was your view, given the book you've just written, given who your father is? What's your reaction to, or your analysis of, Senator Obama's speech in Philadelphia on race?
I thought that was just a remarkable speech. And I understand he wrote it himself, finished it just a couple of hours before he gave it, which I thought was very interesting because he has some very talented speechwriters, obviously, but this was apparently straight from his pen, as it were. And politicians just don't talk like that. Mm-hmm. They don't talk with that kind of honesty and nuance about the issue of race, and it was just that was a speech you watched and you said to yourself, I'm going to be seeing and reading that speech over and over again for the rest of my life because it's historic.
At an event in Washington, there's a panel of Doug Schoen, the pollster, Howell Raines, the former editor of the New York Times, and Karl Rove.
Huh.
And Karl Rove said that he carried around Senator Obama's Philadelphia speech in his briefcase, which to that audience, everyone thought, oh, wow, is he going to praise the speech? And then he said, because it's the most cynical piece of writing he has ever heard and seen in his life.
Well, I guess Karl Rove would know cynical political tactics better than most people, so we have to defer to his expertise. But I have a different opinion. I thought it was a very brave speech because there's so much in there that could be turned into a 30-second attack ad. And, I think Obama has to get credit for being that brave and that nuanced. And if you're predisposed to thinking that everything is politically calculated, then so be it.
Robert Schlesinger, author of White House Ghosts, Presidents and Their Speechwriters, published by Simon & Schuster, thanks so much for coming in.
Jonathan, it was a pleasure.